Well, good morning. Good morning, Tim. You're making a big. Now, here we are. I feel like we've arrived at the point in the gospel that we've been working towards for quite some time. Got earphones in my pocket. I don't need those. It's the point where we actually come face to face with the mocking and crucifixion of Jesus. And of course, next weekend, Good Friday, we'll consider the death, the moment of death, and then Easter Saturday, Sunday, we'll be looking at the resurrection. But here we are this week, looking at these details. We've just had them read to us, the mocking and crucifixion of Jesus. Everything's been moving toward this moment. Jesus has had his eyes fixed on this moment. Now, here we are. It's the moment where Jesus actually wears the crown of thorns. This is where it happens. So let me pray and then we'll dive in. And I will acknowledge this morning that usually I'll look for moments in the sermon where, I don't know, lighter moments where we can have a bit of relief and a giggle. I found it hard to allow those moments with the passage we're looking at here. And so, we'll just deal with what we've got. Okay? Let me pray. Father, we ask for your help this morning as we face the details of your son being mocked and beaten up and crucified. It's hard for us to see and picture. Can only imagine how excruciating it'd be for you to give your son up to this treatment. Lord, help us to feel it, but more so, help us to understand it and come to celebrate you and who you are as our God. Amen. Well, the details here, they are pretty gory, and so they're hard to stomach. If you've been a Christian for many years and you've read these things many times before, it may be that you've grown a little numb, and that can happen. But if you do slow down and you kind of take it in and you take some time and allow yourself to feel it a little bit and picture it, it'll get to you, and it can be quite disturbing. Unless you're the kind of person that loves blood and gore, you know, then you'll probably find this a bit unbearable. It's almost a bit of a horror show, really. My 11-year-old son, he's my oldest son, this week really wanted to watch the first episode of that Netflix series, AD, Kingdom and Empire. And the first episode in that series actually got some graphic depiction of Jesus being beaten and mocked and him being crucified. There are more graphic depictions, but this is fairly graphic, and he really wanted to watch it, and so we talked about it for a bit, and I tried to warn him as much as I could, but in the end he was pretty keen and said, okay, well, we'll see how we go. And so we sat down and we began to watch it, and it's another thing watching a graphic video depiction of the details that we're reading here, you know, we see the blood, and we see the beatings, and we see him being crucified, and it got too much, and so the tears begin to flow, and I need to press stop, and we need to just take time out, we need to take a moment to process, and you know, possibly not go back to it, and you know, I have that moment as a dad where I go, oh no, should I have said yes? Did we watch it too early? I don't know. Maybe you have those moments too as a parent. And maybe you're someone who's like, no, I never want to watch any kind of graphic depiction of what happens here. And that might be wise, actually, because you can never get it perfectly right in a movie. And maybe you don't need to watch that. But I tell you what you do need to do is you do need to read this. And here it is for us in text form. And it's for us, the gory details. And it can be exhausting to go over the details, but here's where we trust it's here for a reason. And I'd suggest one of the reasons is that we're meant to feel it. The ultimate reason is, though, we're meant to understand it, meant to get the big idea of why Jesus would let this happen to him, why God would give his son up to this. How do you understand this, these details? Well, I want to share with you this morning four things that help me handle the horror. And I hope these things will help you handle the horror as well. face the gory details of what's happening here. The first one is this. First thing that helps me handle the horror is understanding that partly what's being described here is just Romans being Romans. So here's the first one. Romans be Romans. And by that I mean Roman soldiers. What's happening here, a lot of the details can be explained by Roman soldiers doing what Roman soldiers did in the first century. So, Jesus walked the earth at a time where the Roman Empire was in control and in control of a vast amount of the civilized society. And the Roman Empire was, you know, one of the most powerful empires in history. One of the ways that they attempted to control the masses, which they were ruling over, and was to display their power to the masses. And the way they did it, particularly, was through the treatment of condemned criminals, and particularly rebels towards Rome. In fact, they'd turned their treatment of criminals into somewhat of an art form. They became experts at turning public executions into a form of entertainment that everyone could come and watch and enjoy. And so the Romans would have fun very deliberately. They'd play games. They even invented sports to be played with criminals, executing them publicly. And this would serve a couple of purposes. Firstly, it would humiliate the criminal publicly. Secondly, it would also send a clear message of warning to anyone else who was considering committing a crime, and particularly the crime of treason against the Roman Empire. Here's how it's going to go for you. That's what the warning would be. It instilled fear into the masses. And so the Romans actually ended up inventing multiple games, murderous games, cruel games, different ways of executing publicly criminals to actually maintain their power and send the message very clearly to everybody. Some of the games you'd be familiar with, you might be familiar with the Colosseum, and the gladiator battles in the Colosseum. Maybe you've seen the movie Gladiator or other movies, or maybe you don't see those movies, which is probably wise. But you'd be aware of it, wouldn't you? And the concept often there was, and here's the thing, you can travel to Rome and see the Colosseum and be amazed, admire the structures and just think how wonderful, and forget actually why that was built originally and what actually happened in the Colosseum. What we're talking about there is the mass murder of convicted criminals in the form of entertainment for everyone to come and watch and clap and cheer at the blood and the gore. And so, unarmed criminals would be just sent in to the arena to see how long they could last against armed gladiators. And eventually they'd be hacked to death. Or prisoners would just be sent in among wild animals to see how long they could run away and survive before they're ripped apart. We know that Christians were actually clothed in lamb's skins and sent in among the lions. And everyone just thought that was fantastic, good fun. But outside the Colosseum, there were many other ways that the Romans invented different games and ways to execute criminals. They often would dress up a criminal. And they invented these like gigantic board games, and they'd dress up criminals and they'd play with them like pieces on a board game, like a game of chess, where, when one piece takes another piece, this one is killed and slaughtered, and they would all sit around and watch these big games that they invented and kill criminals in that way. And when you catch a glimpse of that, and then you see what they're doing to Jesus, you can kind of see it in context. Can you see what they do with Jesus? Jesus gets convicted under the Roman Empire, effectively of treason. He's claiming to be a king. And there's no king in the Roman Empire apart from Caesar. So he's ordered to be executed. And you can almost see the Roman soldiers rubbing their hands together and thinking, fantastic. This guy claims to be the king. We can have some fun with this. And so they do. What they effectively do is they set up and they act out a coronation ceremony. This guy thinks he's king? Well, let's conduct a coronation for this king. We don't think he is. Let's mock him. And that's actually what they do. We read from verse 16 there. The soldiers get Jesus and they take him into the palace, which is where you take the king for the coronation, the royal palace. Now, it's likely the where Pilate lived at the time, would have been his headquarters. They take him in there, and they go there with a crowd of people. They go with a whole company of soldiers, which would have been hundreds, maybe even up to 600. So can you picture that? Like 600 Roman soldiers surrounding Jesus, enacting a mock coronation ceremony. And so they dress him up as a king. They put a purple robe on him. And crowns are hard to come by, so they need to go and make a crown. And this would have taken time and effort and energy to go out and find a thick, thorny bush and get a piece and carve it, to pull it together and make a crown and then ram it on his head. And they all laugh. And then, of course, they sit around paying homage to the king, bowing before him, but it's all sarcastic. Hail, King of the Jews. Bowing, because they're also spitting on him and striking him with sticks and clubs and beating him up. It's a mock coronation ceremony here. And then after this, they take him out to be crucified. And again, this is classic Roman preferred method to execute. Crucifixion actually did exist before the Roman Empire. They just popularized it. They actually, you know, estimates say that the Roman Empire crucified tens of thousands of people. They preferred it and became experts at it because it was helpful for them in a number of ways. You publicly humiliate the criminal. It acts as a visual warning to anybody walking past, and so they do it in public places, like the entry to Jerusalem at the time of festival when many visitors are coming to and from Jerusalem. They can walk past and shake their heads. It was helpful for them because it would last for days often before the criminal died on the cross. And so they'd often offer wine mixed with myrrh because this would kind of numb the pain and dull the senses and actually kind of prolong the whole drama. They'd get more out of it. Dividing up the clothes, that was a common thing that the Roman soldiers would do. You know, they would try and get a piece of the clothing or one of the items of clothing as a trophy or a memento of what they were involved in. They thought it was fantastic. And of course, the notice that goes up above the criminal was so that anyone who could walk past could see why this person is being executed in this way, and they could see what you're not to do against Rome. And you can shake your head at that person in disgust as you walk past and see them in their despicable state. And so there's Jesus with the sign above him, King of the Jews. It's written in three languages. So even the visitors who came to town would know you don't defy the Roman Empire. You don't claim to be king because there's only one king but Caesar. And so you shake your head at him as you walk past. My point here is this. A lot of the gory details that we're looking at here with the mocking and the crucifixion of Jesus can be explained by understanding that this is just Roman soldiers doing what Roman soldiers did in the first century. And I'll be the first to kind of acknowledge that that doesn't really remove the pain of the horror of any of these things really, does it? But it does give you a bit of context, and that does help you understand the whole setting. There's the first one. The second thing that helps me handle the horror of what's happening here for Jesus is by understanding this, that many of the gory details that are going on here actually show God to be trustworthy. So here's the second one. And you might think, what? How can the horror of these things be showing God to be good in any way? But they do. They show God to be trustworthy. And here's how. Many of the details here are actually fulfilling prophecy. Prophecy that was written hundreds and even 1,000 years prior in regards to what the Messiah would go through, what the king would go through when he comes to save. Many of these details were prophesied way in advance. And one of the places that we can go to look at some of that prophecy is Psalm 22. So I'll get you to flick there. We had that read to us. And you know, one of the reasons... Well, the reason why we go to Psalm 22 is because Jesus directs us to go there. You might know that one of the things that Jesus cries out while he's hanging on the cross is, my God, why have you forsaken me? Now, we see in Mark that when Jesus cries out that, no one there in the moment really understood what he was on about. Eloi, Eloi. They thought he was saying something about Elijah. And so they're all just a bit confused. But when Jesus cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? I think that's more for us than for those in the moment, because we're the ones who can reflect on his words and understand the bigger, broader meaning. I mean, it at least was Jesus crying out in desperation, the pain in the moment. But we know it's not simply that. Jesus is actually quoting the first lyric in a famous Jewish song, Psalm 22. And it's a prophetic song. It's almost like as Jesus is hanging on the cross, he's crying out to us as he cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Go and look at Psalm 22 and go and see how so many of the details about what's happening to me right now were prophesied 1,000 years in advance. David would have written this psalm about 1,000 years before the crucifixion. So this is for us, that we would see that these details, so many of these gory details, are not just a mistake, they're not just random, they're actually planned way in advance. Have a look at them. I'll just point out a few. Look at verse 12 through to 15. And picture as we read these verses, Jesus in the palace, surrounded by the whole company of soldiers as they mock him with the fake coronation ceremony. Verse 12, many bulls surround me. Strong bulls of Bashan encircle me. Roaring lions, they tear their prey. They open their mouths wide against me. I'm poured out like water. All my bones are out of joint. My heart has turned to wax. It's melted within me. My mouth is dried up like potsherd. My tongue sticks to the roof of my mouth. You lay me in the dust of death. Is that not a picture of what Jesus is experiencing there in the palace, surrounded by men who are actually beating him up? He would have been dehydrated. Then you read on, verse 16, and now picture Jesus there being crucified, and read this. Dogs surround me, a pack of villains encircle me, they pierce my hands and my feet. And there's the crucifixion. All my bones are on display, people stare and gloat over me. Here I am, up in front of everyone who wants to walk past, naked. People are gloating, staring at me. Verse 18, they divide my clothes among them and cast lots for my garments. How's that? This is not simply Romans doing what Romans do. As they do it, they are unknowingly fulfilling prophecy written 1,000 years in advance about what would happen to God's Son. And then what people say to Jesus while he's hanging there on the cross as they insult him. You kind of flick back to verse 6, 7 and 8, where Jesus says, I'm a worm and not a man. I'm scorned by everybody, despised by people. All who see me mock me. They hurl insults, shaking their heads. That's literally what it says in Mark, that they're walking past, hurling insults, shaking their heads at him. And look at what the insults are. He trusts in the Lord, they say. Let the Lord rescue him. Let him deliver him, since he delights in him. The subject here is, save yourself, mate. Well, why don't you get this God who you trust in to come and save you? Why can't you get help for yourself right now? So similar to the mocking that Jesus is given while he's on the cross. It's all in regards to get yourself down off the cross, mate. You think you're powerful? You think your God's powerful? Why can't you save yourself? It's all so many of the details, the gory details that are so hard to digest in the Gospels, are prophesied way in advance. So many of the people surrounding Jesus, doing these things to Jesus, saying these things to Jesus, have no idea, but what's coming out of their mouth and what they're doing with their hands is actually being prophesied 1,000 years earlier. And there's other psalms you can go to. You go to Psalm 31 and see the detail of the wine and the myrrh that's to be offered to him. You go to the classic Isaiah 53 and see all the details about the suffering servant and how he'd be pierced for our transgressions. There's plenty of places you can go beyond this psalm to see even more detail. But can you see the point? God promised not just the big things, but even the details way in advance. Can you see how many of these things have been prophesied? God said it would happen. And what God says happens. which shows him to be trustworthy. You can trust what he says is true. You can trust what he says is going to happen, will happen. And that is for us today, is it not? That we need to stand and understand that our God can be trusted. So as he makes promises to us, and particularly in regards to the impact of Jesus on our lives, you know, we can trust what he promised. He trusts, you come to me, weary and heavy laden, I'll give you rest. You can trust that he's going to give you real rest, rest for your soul. Come put your trust in me, have your sins forgiven, and your salvation is secured. You can trust that if you put your trust in Jesus, you see him as king, your salvation is secure. You will be with him. You can trust him that when he says, pay great sacrifice during this life. Don't build up treasures on earth. Sacrifice yourself for my kingdom and you'll be building up treasure in heaven. You can trust that whatever you sacrifice for him now, there will be treasure. And it will be better than anything you could picture here. We can trust him that he's worth living for, that there will be reward beyond anything you can imagine. There is security for you and me in him in the future. We can trust him. He's trustworthy. So all this kind of helps me handle the horror as I see how even the gory details are fulfilling prophecy and showing my God to be trustworthy. There's the second one. Here's a third thing that kind of helps me handle the horror. It's to know that what's actually happening here is securing our salvation. It's the third thing. These gory details actually secure our salvation. And particularly the details about Jesus hanging on the cross. Because this is what's actually happening on the cross. It's our salvation in motion, being enacted. Many criminals, as they were crucified, would last for a day or a couple of days before they died. Jesus died a relatively short death on the cross. He only hung there for 6 hours. But geez, that's long enough, isn't it? 6 hours, no pain relief. 6 hours struggling to breathe. It would have been really easy to look and see 6 hours of appearing to be defeated. But we know, as we look at these details, that actually something huge is being achieved in this horrific moment. Jesus was there bearing our sin. And particularly, he's there bearing God's judgment for our sin. He's taking upon himself the wrath of the Father so that we can be saved. We can be forgiven. The innocent one is condemned, so the guilty ones can go free. Our salvation is being secured in this moment of horror. And there's plenty of indicators in the Gospels that there is definitely something more going on than simply an ordinary criminal being crucified like every other one. And the indicators are everywhere. I'll give you a couple of them. You know, the prayer that Jesus prays in the garden before he even gets to the cross, and he talks about the cup that he knows he's going to drink. So here he is on the cross, really drinking the cup, which is the cup of God's wrath. He's actually taking into himself the judgment that the world deserves. He's dealing with it for us. Other indicators, the darkness that comes over the land. For 3 hours, smack bang in the middle of the day. That would have been pretty spooky. But we can see that as an indicator actually of God's judgment coming upon his son, there in that moment. The cry of Jesus, my God, why have you forsaken me, helps us see that there's more than just physical pain going on in this moment. The son is being forsaken by the father as he bears the wrath of the father on our behalf. Other details like the earthquake, the ground shakes, the rocks split open, dead people come back to life, start walking around Jerusalem. The temple curtain gets torn in two. Jesus cries out, it's finished. What's finished? No, the paying for our sin. It's finished. I've done it. You know, there are so many indicators here that help us see that this is more than just the physical pain of a common criminal being crucified. We know something huge is being achieved. We know that this is actually the most spiritually significant moment in history, our salvation being secured. And knowing that helps me handle the horror. Yeah? Because as hard as it is to face, what is horrific here is actually, it's actually wonderful. And I'm so glad that Jesus went through this. I'm so glad he didn't come down off the cross like everyone was jeering at him to do. Come down, mate. You've saved others. Why don't you save yourself? You think you're the king? Well, come down off the cross and then we'll be able to believe and see that you are the king. All the jeering was in regards to save yourself. Get yourself off the cross. And that kind of makes sense to jeer in that way, because if someone claims to be king and powerful and claims to be able to save others, they ought to be able to save themselves, right? And he could have. That's the thing. Jesus absolutely could have got himself off the cross. Easily. In fact, more than that, he could have called down, as he says in Matthew chapter 26, he could have called down to his aid, you know, 12 legions of angels from heaven. He could have just brought a whole army of angels in that moment to release him and obliterate any enemies towards him. Gee, he just could have done it in a moment. But he lets this happen instead. Jesus chooses to stay and die. He chooses to not save himself when he easily could have, in order to save others. So as I see Jesus here in this moment suffering so horrifically, I actually see my God willing and determined to save sinners like me and like you. And that's wonderful. I see my salvation in motion. And I'm so glad I have a God who saves. Because that's desperately what I need. So that helps me handle the horror to see that actually in this moment, my salvation, your salvation, is being secured. And the fourth one, the fourth thing that helps me handle the horror of all this is to know that despite all this happening to Jesus, despite the humiliation, despite the crucifixion, Jesus still reigns. Yeah? And here's the thing we've got to see. His kingship is not affected by this moment. Jesus' position as the powerful sovereign ruler of the earth is still well and truly intact, even in this moment, these horrific moments. He reigns. Now, it may not look like that, and if you're kind of new to these things, you might be scratching your head thinking, how on earth? This does not look like a king who's in control. This more looks like a king who's being toppled, you know, overpowered off his throne. Maybe that's what it looks like. But make no mistake, everything that's happening here is going according to plan. Exactly. What we have here is a king who is deliberately enduring suffering. He's willingly taking it upon himself because he's no ordinary king. He's the servant king. He's the one who lays down his own life and allows himself to be humiliated and crushed to save his people. He's the servant king. And you know, the servant king is the real king. The servant king is the King of Kings, and he's the Lord of Lords. He's actually the only king. And he's everybody's king. And even in these moments of him being mocked and crucified and humiliated, he doesn't cease to be king. His kingship is not impacted and affected. He remains the Lord of the universe even in these moments. That helps me handle the horror. Don't think for a minute that Jesus was surprised by what was happening to him here or even intimidated by these events. And don't think for a minute that our God is knocked around or rocked by human opposition. Don't think for a minute that our God is left feeling insecure in any way by our defiance of him. He grieves, absolutely. He grieves our rebellion towards him, but he doesn't whimper or crumble because of humanity's hard-hearted stupidity. No, God has installed his king. His king, his name is Jesus, and his king will remain. While we're in Psalm, flick back to the second Psalm, Psalm 2, which is one of the places you can go to actually see how God responds to human rebellion as the king. We looked at this last week. It's the classic psalm that just features worldwide human rage against the Lord and his anointed one particularly. Look at the first few verses, Psalm 2. Why do the nations conspire and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth rise up and the rulers band together against the Lord and against his anointed. Friends, what we're seeing here with Jesus being mocked and crucified is the climax. It's the hot point of the world rising up against the Lord and his anointed. It's the moment where God comes down and is face to face with humanity in such a way that humanity has the opportunity to actually physically turn upon him, and that's exactly what they choose to do. It's so tragic. But how does God respond when he comes face to face with humanity and humanity just wants to rebel and rise up and crush him and appears to be successful at doing that? How does God respond? Look at verse 4. The one enthroned in heaven laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. He rebukes them in his anger and he terrifies them in his wrath, saying, I've installed my king on Zion, my holy mountain. So how does God respond and react to rebellious humanity coming at him? Well, he laughs and he scoffs. Which isn't to say God is enjoying it in any way or thinking it's funny. No, he laughs and scoffs at the stupidity of human rebellion. He's just like holding his head and just going, this is so dumb. You know, your attempts to defy me are just so futile because I've installed my king and he won't be knocked off his throne. His name is Jesus, and he's the one who has all the authority, and he will exercise his authority. So any kind of rising up against me and trying to take me down, it's so futile. And so God scoffs at human attempts to come against him. Because Jesus, the enthroned king, will have the final say and does have the final say. He's the sovereign Lord of all the earth. And if that's the case, then we're instructed by this psalm how we are meant to approach him, which is the very opposite of rising up against him and rebelling. It's to actually come before him humbly, bow before him, and as it says in verse 12, kiss the Son. It's interesting language, kiss the Son. The Son meaning the Son of God, that is God's King on earth. Kiss the King. That's the appropriate way to approach the king. You don't rise up against him. You don't rebel against him. You don't try and chuck off his chains. You don't try and take him down. You kiss the Son. And so in the ancient world, to kiss the king, you'd come before him. You'd bow low. He'd put his hand down to you. You'd kiss his hand or you'd kiss his ring. And as you did that, that would be a sign of submission and surrender to him, that you're giving up your rebellion against him and instead you decide to take refuge in him. And serve him and celebrate his rule and do it with reverence and trembling because that's appropriate. That's how you approach the king. And as I consider that, I can't help but to think, oh, the soldiers. The soldiers who put together their mock coronation, bringing Jesus into the palace, and dressing him up, putting the crown on his head, paying homage to him in a sarcastic way, hail, bowing. How tragically ironic that they would do that. Can you see the irony? Their actions and words spoke louder than they ever knew because Jesus truly was the king. And he was the one to bow before. And in fact, this is Jesus' coronation as the servant king. Contrary to their view, Jesus truly was the king of the Jews. And more than that, king of the nations, the Lord of lords. And they would soon find themselves on their final day again standing before Jesus as king and bowing before him, but without a hint of sarcasm. recognizing him to be the true king and trembling in reverence before him as the Lord of Lords, but it will have been all too late for them. You see, none of what happens to Jesus impacts his kingship. He reigns as the Lord of Lords. And knowing that and remember that helps me handle the horror. Because even in the midst of all this, Jesus is the king. And he's the one to bow before. Despite all the mocking and crucifixion, Jesus remains unimpacted, not weakened in his kingship. And he shows that very clearly by what happens after he's mocked and crucified and killed. He rises again from the dead in power to show that he is the Lord of life. And then he ascends back into heaven. And he is seated today at the right-hand side of the Father in that position as judge. And he promises that he will return again and judge the living and the dead. This is who he is. This is what he will do. And today is the day to bow before him in reverence and serve him and celebrate him and submit to him and stop rebelling against him. This is our life. To serve him as king. And as we reflect on Jesus' life and we see even these most horrific moments for him, we know that he was still king there, still reigns then, still reigns now, and will reign forever as the Lord of the universe. He's the King of Kings. Today is the day to bow before him and continue to recognize him. I'll leave it there. Let me pray. Father, thank you for your word. Even these horrific parts where we see Jesus being mocked and tortured and crucified, we can only imagine how it was for you to hand your son over to this and then watch it happen. Father, we see your astounding love for us in all of this. And we're helped to handle the horror knowing that many of these details were fulfilling promises and prophecy that you had set 1,000 years in advance, showing you to be trustworthy. In this moment of horror, we see this is our salvation being secured. And despite all of this, we see Jesus still reigns and will reign forever. Lord, help us by your Spirit to bow before your King and kiss the King. Help us to serve him in reverent fear, and to celebrate his rule over us, knowing that there can be nothing better for us. Lord, we long for the people around us to bow the knee and kiss the King and acknowledge Jesus as the Lord. Please use us to help them see. Call people to bow the knee. Bring glory to your name. Amen.